Hey, welcome to Undaunted. My name is David Gunger. Today we have a conversation with Monique Verdan, an indigenous woman from the Houma tribe living in South Louisiana. After being raised on the stories of her people living in and on the land, Monique returned later in life to find herself documenting the harm happening against her people and the land. We shared a conversation on the stories of her life, of the often silent stories of indigenous communities across the nation, and what it means to love our home even when it hurts us, or even when it's dying before our eyes.
You can know this about any place. Someone loved it, and someone lost it. And the people who love it now came ragamuffin refugees, washed up, wretched, empty-handed, muttering a deal they made with this place. What blood for them in pity to feed their dirty, cold children. For the sea had been hard on them, and they were strong, but they were not fish. And they said they would love the land and put by from their stores to feed it and pay back what the land had given. And their children would live amongst the gamma grass and the roseau cane, and they would call this place kin. And they would spin fine stories and songs of the old country to keep the land company. And these songs they would tie into their nets and stretch them across the sky to haul in a load of stars to twinkle with the tide. And so great was their bounty, and so deep was their gratitude and reverence. And when they died, they would go under the water and wait as fish to hear the oldest song sung by the youngest heirs. And they would leap into the nets to feed their own kin, and the cycle would begin again.
That's Monique Verdan with an original poem she wrote called Fish. Monique, I think there's a certain gravitational pull towards people like you who love where they live and address their home's past and trauma and pain, and yet are also building a home to make it a better place. I would love to know your story and your connection to Louisiana.
So the lower Mississippi River Delta, the Choctaw referred to this territory as Bulbuncha, which means place of many tongues or place of many languages. The colonizers were really good at rebranding this place that I call home as New Orleans. And my history is tied to this place where many different kinds of people have occupied a crossroads or waterway entry point and place where tradition, where exchange of goods and ideas has been happening for a really long time. But it was this 300-year anniversary of New Orleans when I first heard Bulbuncha. And I was so angry in that most of my adult life, I've been trying to understand who I am and where my people have come from and like how we ended up here. I've been thinking a lot about the conflict of family and place and ownership of land and how one can claim territory as their own, but the interconnectedness that can't be denied. The French had a very different relationship with indigenous people than the Americans. The Louisiana Purchase happened in 1803. The Civil War happens in 1865. Civil rights movement happens in the 1960s. My father's generation, they were the first generation to be allowed into integrated public schools. So my grandparents in the 1940s, they left the bayous of Terrebonne Parish, of the Yaknishido, the big country between the Atchafalaya and Mississippi, and they moved closer to New Orleans, to St. Bernard Parish, where they were working as cheap laborers, pulling mink, muskrat, and otter out of the marshes, which were still a big industry. My grandmother always says she went to St. Bernard for a better life. They were able to buy land. They were brown people, but everybody in Louisiana is brown. So they were able to pass and were able to vote and were able to go to school and were able to find employment and opportunity. I say all of that in that I recognize that my father's closeness to the urban center brings my mother and my father like this kind of reclashing of Houma and settlers coming back together, and just that reconciling with these two sides of myself, because I've understood the Houma story in a way that has been told to me in this oral history. It's not the written. And now I'm recognizing the injustices that still exist and that the strategies that have been used and how the documents can be used against you and how the documents can disappear. And in thinking a lot lately about the patriarchy, and that Houma people are a matriarchal society, and to see how even in my grandmother's passing, so she lived to be 101 years old, and yeah, just an amazing, amazing wise human being that I was so blessed to learn from and be loved by. Her passing in our own family land, how if you don't have that anchor, who's this is ours, we share, we all own, we respect each other and our neighbors and the plants and the creatures that are sharing the space with us. How when you lose that anchor, how then people want to fight over little pieces that really is a couple thousand dollars now. And what will it be in the future if we're saying, hey, 2050, South Louisiana might not exist? I remember my grandmother telling a story of being a girl with an old auntie of mine, and they were out in the marsh and they were trapping, and this man told them to get out of here, and they were like, get off my land, like you're on our land. And I think of that story a lot. I just recently actually was on my land in St. Bernard Parish, and there was a man with a shotgun and had a dog that he was training, and I asked him very nicely to get off of the property, that it was family land. And he actually told me he was going to call the cops on me. And I had this real trigger where I was like, oh my God, this is like how it went down. I started to think how someone can claim their territory as their own.
So your ancestors lived on this land and you returned to it later to find a story unfolding before you of harm against the people of South Louisiana and harm against the actual land. And so you decide to make this film, which you called My Louisiana Love. Can you tell me about the story of that film?
So I returned to South Louisiana in the late 1990s. And at that time, my Houma relatives in Grandbois, Louisiana, in the heart of the Yaknishido, were up against a fight with an oil waste facility that is located less than 1,500 feet from where my cousins live. And that's really why I picked up a camera and wanted to document this injustice. Like, people should know that this is happening. And then I didn't, at that time, I was so naive, you know, I was like a girl. I didn't realize that, like, that happens all the time everywhere, which is unfortunate, but was definitely the start for me. And yeah, I think that I never really photographed the waste pits much. What I started to recognize was how unique and special my Houma family was, and that there was also this bigger story looming, a reality of the loss of land here and the oil and gas industries. And so I just started compulsively collecting images and video and wanting to just create a record. And I've really thought of myself as a witness and tried to put together the pieces to understand how we got here. And so a lot of my artwork has been tied to that understanding. And so My Louisiana Love was a product of that compulsive collecting and also amazing collaborations with Mark Krasnoff and also my best friend Sharon Linazzo Hong. And really, the film came out and I didn't realize that I was going to be then, I don't know, put into this role of being a spokesperson for South Louisiana. And also, I cringe when folks introduce me as being an artist and activist, because I'm like, oh my God, activist is like a dirty word in South Louisiana. People roll their eyes and they think you're crazy or you're radical, which I've also come to realize that it shouldn't be radical to want clean water and like a safe place to live, but often get cast into that category. But yeah, I've been doing more sharing the film, sharing the story, and continuing the conversation. And at the time when My Louisiana Love came out in 2012, we weren't dropping the climate change word around. Like, it was not part of our common conversations. Now we say it all the time. But I think the story has become more and more relevant in just recognizing how we got here. And I'm still trying to understand, and I'm still trying to witness to, and recognizing that there's just so many layers all the time.
You're giving witness to your own story and family and community and land. And part of that bearing witness is you creating. And then that leads to things like advocacy. But I find so many times the hard thing about art and advocacy is that it feels more like propaganda than it does art, because it's either one side is correct and one side is wrong and this is injustice. And the wonderful thing that you've eloquently talked about, even within your own story, is like how convoluted and mixed and hard it is to just get a clear picture of a place and the tensions that exist. Even the tensions of you speaking, like I thought of, it's a thing from the Bible, but it says a prophet in their hometown is without honor. Like how hard it is to actually speak about real issues and do so in an artistic way to a community where it could almost feel like if you're making a critique about something, you're making a critique of them or their style of life or the way that they make money. So for instance, if you're speaking out about chemicals and about these plants or about the oil industry, but the oil industry is helping on a certain sense give jobs and those types of things, I can see that being very threatening to a lot of people. Can you talk about a little bit of the tension of living as an artist in a community and also critiquing a larger systematic thing?
I wrestle with it all the time. My stepfather worked in the oil field for 35 years as a crew boat captain. So I, as my old cousin used to say, don't go pointing any fingers because you got three coming back at you. I think that I've tried to recognize, and I do deeply appreciate the hard work that so many of my people who are tied to the oil fields do. You know, they're dedicated, they're hardworking, they can make things work that aren't supposed to work. They're like magicians, like mechanic magicians, some of them. And I think that if we just allow ourselves to believe that this is all we got, then it's only going to get worse. I think that we're in a time where we need to reimagine how we can reclaim our sovereignty here. I think that part of my record making has been to allow the next generation, the younger generation behind me, to understand. I feel like I was on this cusp of being with the elders who were really deeply connected to the land and know this place. Also connecting the politics at play, where I think that a lot of my people who are working for the oil field or live next to the pipeline don't recognize that there are these world banks that are financing these this legacy of injustice is, and they're making a way lot more money than your $15 an hour and health insurance that you're so grateful to have, which I get. But also, so I think that a lot of my own process has been being like, oh yeah, the federal government is leasing all of these deep water wells in the Gulf of Mexico. It's they're essentially drilling for oil on the moon out there. And like the risk, the roll of the dice that we're taking, and also us all knowing what the consequences can be. BP was a lesson and a warning, I think. But they continue to double down on deep water drilling. And now I think, too, what we're not thinking about is like marine mining. That's something that is, the ocean is the new frontier. So I have a place to live, but for planetary water quality, because this is where 41% of the United States water is flowing down and out into the Gulf of Mexico, connecting to all the ocean basins of the world. So I think we think about land a lot. We don't think about water as much and how there's that interface and that in between. I think that the Mississippi Delta is a magical place because it is that in between place where salt and fresh kiss and meet, and where life comes to be born, and where birds come to rest on their migrations. I think as keepers of this place, the more I think about being a better steward and what does it mean to live in deep relationship with the nature. So every 100 minutes, they say a football field of land is lost from South Louisiana's shore, and that there's been a landmass larger than the state of Delaware that's been lost since the 1930s. And of course, that's running parallel with a lot of infrastructure. So levees being put in on the Mississippi River to protect from flooding. But let's remember, navigation is huge, especially here in the lower Mississippi River Delta. This is one of the biggest ports on the planet, bringing in everything from rubber and other kinds of petrochemicals and shipping out the grains of the breadbaskets of America. So I think when I think about territory, the more I think about it, the less I believe in ownership, but also at the same time, these are the designs of our governmental systems that we have to abide by. So for me, I have this vision of the territories that are disappearing. As the state of Louisiana is putting forth more of a put your house 20 feet in the sky or leave. So this lift or leave scenario is very real. And the Great Migration has already begun. People are moving further north. They're moving inside risk reduction levees.
Monique, can you tell me more about what's happening within your own community and why your story is so important to hear right now?
The reason why we are experiencing land loss at such a rapid rate here in South Louisiana is for a couple of reasons. One is the leveling of the Mississippi River. Another, of course, global sea level rise due to climate change. We are subsiding. We're in a delta, so we're naturally sinking because land is compacting. But because of the extraction of natural resources, oil and gas, sulfur, we're experiencing more exacerbated fault sinkage happening as well. This is across the coast of South Louisiana. And the state is rolling out lift your house, especially if you're outside of levee risk reduction. You have to have your house 20 feet up in order to get flood insurance outside of the levees. But even then, flood insurance is running about $20,000 a year for some places. So many people are already moving inland. And yeah, the services, the schools have like in lower St. Bernard Parish or eastern St. Bernard Parish where I live, the schools are closing. The little grocery stores, they're not there anymore. So we're seeing communities changing. I'm actually right in our family land in eastern St. Bernard is right inside of the levee, but I don't have much faith in it. These levees, I think the federal government's built like over $1 billion to build this big levee after Hurricane Katrina, which hit in 2005 and totally was a disaster here, one of many. But I don't have much faith in it. They say that some of the sheet pilings that they put in, they didn't coat with a special rust protectant or what have you, and they just shoved it in some pudding soil. And the soil types are so different here that the levee's already sunk between 3 and 6 or maybe more feet since it was finalized, which wasn't that long ago. And we know that the 100-year storm happens all the time now, all over the place. So what I've been really thinking more about is, instead of lifting in or leaving, the lift or leave scenario, what if we remain and reclaim in a different kind of way? And so I've been thinking deeply about, how do you live with water in a way that is sustainable and provides opportunity, instead of us constantly fighting back the water? It's like, how do we actually respect that the water, for whatever reason, by nature's design or by man's trying to make solutions, sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. Engineering is a big question here. But ultimately, yeah, we have to live with the water and we have to respect it in a way. Floating adaptations has definitely been on the mind here.
Monique, when you're talking with people within your own community, how do they deal with the existential threat of climate change, and what kind of conversations are bringing you hope?
In my community, don't like to think about what's on the horizon. The storm comes, we sweep the water out, we put our blinders on, and we get back to work. We just want to get back to normal. And there is not a normal anymore here. I've been trying to simply create space for people to be able to reflect and share how much has changed so quickly. So there's a project that I work collaboratively with folks from Another Gulf as Possible, which is a collaborative of people from Pensacola, Florida to Brownsville, Texas, along the Gulf South, predominantly women who are looking for just solutions in transitions. And we recognize that the Gulf South has been the sacrifice zone for too long. There are a lot of skills here that are being used for the old ways. Hopefully we start talking about them as the old ways, tied to building oil rigs or building boats that push barges or what have you. So how can we tap into those skills to build the transitions that we need? We definitely need more resources here and belief here and investment here in alternative energies, because right now, the oil and gas industry has totally saturated not only the economy, but also the cultural sex of our society. So the museums are all funded by the oil and gas industry. There are schools that are funded by oil and gas industry. There's the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, brought to you by Shell Oil. You know, what that means is that the corporations are pushing their brand for a reason. You can't run from climate change. And I think that the cycle of disasters that I have witnessed and lived through in my life has taught me a lot about how or what is important as we move forward in these uncertain times, and knowing that there will be more disasters in the future. These are my beautiful people that have cared for me and are my family. And so to protect them, just as I want to make sure that we have clean water and a forest to walk in and medicine that we have access to. But I do sway sometimes between feeling totally insane and like doubling down on a doomed place. But I feel like there's a ritual at place, and I have a role in that. And if that means there's obviously more that I have to learn here before I can pick up and go. But I definitely have been thinking more of in a retreat and return. I think we have a right to remain and reclaim. There is no live oak tree like the one in my backyard or that cypress tree where my studio is that's been watching me all these years. I don't know, it feels silly, but it also is. But as I drive past these two big oil refineries every day, I'm like, am I killing myself? I know this is not good for anybody, but this place is like a microcosm. There's so many realities here that are reflected all over the planet. And this is my place. This is my home. And I'm going to try to love it as much as I can, as long as I can. But I do know that there may come a time where I can't come home. I've dealt with that. I've felt that before and thought I had to let go at one point in time 15 years ago. And I've learned a lot from this place since then that I'm so grateful for. Even with its bad air and poor water quality and crazy creatures all around. What I'm just trying to find is, where can we stay connected to our home? Because I think that, as I was saying, so many people don't want to, they just want to get back to normal. But I think it also is recognizing that we have a new, we're going into uncharted territories. And how can we stay connected? Like, you can put your blinders on and pretend like you're not a part of it. But as my younger cousin said so clearly one day, what is one person's comfort is taking away another person's way of life. And that your way of life can be taken away too. I think that I often say South Louisiana is a really good bad example for all of our like folks that are up in North Dakota who are fighting pipeline expansion, those who are in the tar sands in Canada, those pipelines are connected. So stuff that's going from Canada, this like the dirtiest crude is going to cross the United States and go to the Gulf of Mexico for international exports. So I think that like that's a really good example, but there's that's just a metaphor for even our use of single-use plastics. And so these little small things, they all add up, especially here in the South. I'm often like, oh my God, recycling is just garbage. It's just a joke. Nobody's really recycling. And often we've found that, yeah, not so much. I haven't heard here in Louisiana, but in places like Florida, yeah, they would just dump it into landfills. So I think that what are our real solutions? And when we're talking about just transitions, we can talk about building as another Gulf collaborative that I'm working with right now. We have this cisterns project. So we've been thinking a lot about water. How do we catch our own rainwater? How do we have water sovereignty? What does that look like? It also is holding the banks accountable. It's okay, Mr. Guy Credit Suisse, like, you just are allowing these violations. That's not only happening in my backyard, but it's also happening in Vancouver. So these and until they stop the financing, the front line is going to continue feeling the effects. But we also talk often about how there are these solutions. They're just like they've been untapped. We haven't had the ability to build what we want because we've been fighting too long against the things that we don't want. But there's a balance. We have to stop bad behavior and also have accountability in a way that's never happened before, and be honest. Let's be honest that climate change is happening, and let's be honest that the banks have helped bankroll it, and let's be honest that the corporations are fueling the fire.
Monique, what brings you hope as an Indigenous woman living in the Southeast?
I really have been in such admiration of these young Indigenous women. And I've been describing them as, I feel like they've been just like rising up out of the dirt and coming together. So the Bolbuncha Collective, some of these women have been making medicine together. They're thinking collectively about purchasing land that has water access, having ceremony together. That I don't feel like is necessarily my work, but I definitely feel like in the work that I've been doing and being more vocal, that others have felt that they can identify in this modern time as being Indigenous and not being discriminated against. What's interesting about the Southeast that's different from the Anishinaabe, for example. So I was up at the headwaters of the Mississippi in the fall of 2019. And I had this real kind of aha moment at one point in time where I was like, oh, so the Anishinaabe were pretty smart in how they were able to negotiate their treaties, which is very different than some of the other tribes. And in regards to the Homa, we have a totally different scenario, and we don't have a territory, a reservation territory. And how the isolation preserves culture in a way that assimilation changes a whole dynamic, but also at the same time, there's a sense of mobility and that comes with the integration as well, and access to other things that the isolation quarantines off, for lack of a better description. And I also was thinking how it was like really interesting, like racism is like, whatever, racism is real. And here in the South, like, yeah, I got neighbors that got a Confederate flag flying. Like that's, yeah, they're everywhere. But being up at the headwaters, it was like, oh, wow, you know, these boundaries. You cross outside of the reservation and it's obviously very white and the racism is there and people might all be being really nice to each other. And it was a weird tension that I had never really felt before. Definitely not here where people in South Louisiana are pretty brown and coming from all over the world.
Have you been scrutinized for your work?
When we were making My Louisiana Love, we were afraid like, that the Indigenous Native American community wasn't going to accept us because we were like, weren't Indian enough. And the truth is that I'm just as Indigenous as anyone else. I carry that with me. And then when people often get challenged, well, you guys don't have a tribe, really, you don't have a reservation. And yeah, but we have a connection to this place. And what I feel makes me Indigenous to this place is that like my DNA knows this place, like this land, this water, the plants and the animal, like it's all been feeding who I have been and who I am now, what's gotten me to this point. And that is my grandmother's connections and those traditions that were given to me. That's valid. And I think that for so many people in the Southeast, because they've been disconnected from their own territories, because they've been disconnected from their traditions, but to see this like recognizing and looking back, but also in the resurrection, in a sense, reforming and moving forward as culture is constantly being reshaped and redefined. And again, Buncha, a place of many tongues, place of many languages, place of many ideas and ways of being, and that we're all growing and we take with us everything from the past and we need to look back for solutions, but we have to envision something else for the future, something that is respecting the natural intelligence of this planet that we all call home.
Monique Verdin, thank you for joining us today. If you're interested in supporting Undaunted, we've got a Patreon. Also, please go to our website, thetelosgroup.org. We would love if you'd sign up for our newsletter, as well as check out what webinars we've got going on. Please follow us on Twitter and on Instagram and rate us on iTunes. Give us a review if you don't mind. Next week, we'll be back with a brand new episode of Undaunted. My name is David Gunger. I hope that you'll stay curious.